Morning, Council. Before we begin the argument, it's our pleasure to welcome guests to our court from Japan and from Colombia.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're happy to be here and to see the oral argument and understand how we do it in our system.
Well, you're all welcome. I hope you enjoy the argument. You're fortunate in that you have very good lawyers who are making the presentation today, and if they weren't already on the spot, they certainly are now. Council, ready to begin?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Brian Farn on behalf of the appellant, Elizabeth Sammons, in her individual capacity and in her capacity as a representative of her daughter, Gail, who we contend death was caused by the medical negligence of the defendants. There are many issues on this appeal. This morning, however, I will address what we believe are the major issues in our papers and rely on the arguments in our papers for the issues that are not discussed. Turning to the first area of the trial court, allowing counsel for Doctors for Emergency Services to discuss plaintiff's settlement with ChristianaCare during opening statement and closing argument. Rule 408 clearly prohibits parties from discussing settlements before the jury. This court in Alexander v. Cahill stated that a party cannot reference settlements in an attempt to shift liability or to establish a claim was invalid.
Was the mention of settlement at all that you believe is error, or exactly what was said in the context of discussing the settlement?
It's the manner and what was said, Your Honor. You could address settlement under that, under holding in Alexander versus Cahill for purposes of alignment of the parties, for purposes of to avoid jury confusion. In this case, it was done on three occasions. In the opening statement, it was said that ChristianaCare was responsible for the nurses carrying out the orders. And it was said they didn't do that. They were responsible, and they settled. And the theme continued into the closing argument, first by saying people made mistakes in this case, but the mistakes were made by ChristianaCare. And so when plaintiff's counsel argues to you, telling the jury, that the defendants have not admitted their mistakes, well, maybe people have admitted their mistakes, referring to ChristianaCare. Then it followed with talking about that a nurse had been around when Gail vomited. And they said, and here's what he said, quote, "That was ChristianaCare's responsibility," and quote, "but ChristianaCare has settled. They're not here. That's their responsibility." These were all arguments made in an attempt to shift liability from Doctors for Emergency Services and Family Practice to ChristianaCare, and evidenced by the fact that ChristianaCare settled this case.
Was there an order in place to put limits on the extent to which settlement could be discussed by counsel?
Prior to trial, in our pretrial order, we raised the issue and cited the case for the court. The court instructed the parties to come up with a jury instruction that the court would read before trial and after trial. We drafted an instruction, sent to the defendants. They ignored our letter. We then sent our letter and the instruction to the trial court proposing how the jury should be addressed before and after trial. Now, turning to the second error, the trial court prohibited...
Wait a minute. You didn't answer my question. Did the trial judge follow up and enter an order, and was there an instruction read both before the case began and as a part of the regular and ordinary instructions at the end of the case to the jury?
An order was never entered by a trial judge. There was no instruction read by the trial judge before the trial. Pattern instruction 2219 was read as part of the jury instruction.
Well, did the trial judge explicitly reject your request, or did you renew your request before the jury went out?
Prior to trial, we renewed our request in chambers to the judge. We had a new judge for the trial. We told him about this issue, that we submitted an instruction to read to the jury. The trial judge didn't rule on it, then came back and on the record and said they can argue settlements. They just can't argue the amount or how much they were paid, which clearly is not the law under Alexander versus Cahill. Now, turning to the second error, the trial court precluded Dr. Bridges from testifying on the topic of sepsis at trial. Dr. Bridges is a world-renowned hematologist from Harvard University. He was prepared to offer opinion at trial that Gail suffered from sepsis on January 4, 2002. This opinion was revealed during his deposition prior to the expert discovery deadline. However, the trial court refused to allow Dr. Bridges to offer this opinion at trial. Now, the law in this area was best summarized by Doctor for Emergency Services counsel during an oral argument before the trial court when he said, quote, Dr. Bridges could not offer testimony, quote, beyond what he said in his deposition. This is consistent with the case law we cite in our papers. Additionally, Rule 2060 allows a party to supplement expert disclosures which is exactly what Dr. Bridges did in this case.
Well, and, who supplements the disclosures? As I understand the record, you sent an initial notice indicating who your experts would be, the opinions they would give, and reference to the factual substance to support those opinions. Other than Dr. Bridges testifying at his deposition about causation, did you ever supplement that document that you had earlier filed and directly put defense on notice that you were going to add to Dr. Bridges' earlier announced opinion by supplementing it, by offering him for the purpose of discussing causation?
No, Your Honor, but we did in the context of his deposition. We could have easily, at the conclusion of the deposition, sat down and wrote it out and sent it to them prior to the expert discovery deadline.
Is that what my question is, what do the rules contemplate? So when the trial begins, everybody knows exactly what the experts are being offered for, what their opinions would be, and what is the factual basis for those opinions.
The rules contemplate notice. And in this case, the defendants were clearly on notice. During his deposition, he had causation opinions.
All right, so your view is the rule contemplates that somewhere during the course of discovery, people can figure out that the witness has an opinion. But the rules don't, in your view, contemplate you specifically supplementing an earlier document and saying, in addition to the opinion on life expectancy, Dr. Bridges will also be called for the purpose of offering an opinion on causation. You didn't have to take that extra step, is your view?
If there wasn't a deposition going forward, we would have to take that step. And if we failed to do that, I would submit he would be precluded. But since they chose to take his deposition, which they're not entitled to under Delaware civil rules, that was a supplement to comply with the rules. And that's consistent with the case law that we cite in our briefs.
Is it consistent with the practice in Superior Court, and is that a consistent expected ruling from Superior Court judges in similar situations?
In my experience, I can only speak on my experience, if a disclosure is disclosed in the deposition, that's considered fair notice.
What happens if a deposition is taken before the pretrial stipulation and there's notice that a doctor may have two separate opinions, as two distinct opinions in the deposition, but the pretrial stipulation that's submitted about who the experts are and what they will testify to only states one opinion? What controls?
The pretrial order. And I think the order say that should control all matters going forward.
Okay, did this pretrial order say Dr. Bridges would be giving two opinions, one on life expectancy and one on causation?
He was offered, but they ruled at the pretrial conference he could not testify. It was a motion limit. It was ruled on at the pretrial conference.
Okay.
Now, that takes us to the third error committed by a trial court, which excluding Dr. Bridges was compounded by the fact that the trial court allowed Dr. Zelman to testify at trial on the topic of sepsis. Dr. Zelman was an expert identified by Dr. Roakes for the standard of care that Dr. Roakes provided to Gale on January 3, 2002 at St. Francis Hospital. And he gave also a one-line disclosure that Gale did not die from septic shock. In the first instance, DFIS should have been permitted.
Now, how was that disclosure made? That was pursuant to the designation of the experts and what they would testify about?
Yes, Your Honor.
As opposed to the deposition?
Yes, by Dr. Roakes' counsel. In the first instance, DFIS should not have been allowed to use Dr. Zelman because they never identified him. The only parties in this case.
Somewhere in the record, there's a suggestion that the plaintiff's counsel was told that the defendants had agreed to use each other's expert. Is that not correct?
No, that's not correct. We were on no notice whatsoever that Doctors for Emergency Service would use anyone's experts but their own.
Well, what about the pretrial order? Did that say anything about the defendants reserve the right to call any witness identified by any other party?
At the pretrial order, it did. But there was no disclosure prior to the pretrial order. And we filed our motion in limine prior to the pretrial order. And DFIS, after adopting Dr. Zelman belatedly, they then tried to turn him into their own expert. And they tried to make Dr. Zelman their own expert in three regards. First, in his new disclosure, he said he had opinions about Gail's medical condition on January 4, 2002. Opinions about whether she had sepsis, about her blood pressure, and about her blood work. His prior disclosures, I just stated, were for the standard for her medical condition on January 3, 2002 when she was at St. Francis. Additionally, the second point is, in the new disclosure, it stated Doctors for Emergency Services complied with the standard of care when they administered antibiotics to Gail on January 4, 2002. He was retained by Dr. Roakes to give standard of care testimony on January 3, 2002. There was absolutely no disclosure about the standard of care on January 4, 2002. And the third point is, He also expanded on his one-line disclosure that said Gale did not die of septic shock by adding that there was no evidence of infection found at autopsy and that there was no damage to the end organs, all of which was not contained in the original disclosure. And that takes us to the fourth error. After allowing Dr. Zelman to testify at trial, the trial court precluded plaintiff's counsel from impeaching Dr. Zelman when his testimony directly contradicted Dr. Ford Emergency Services' own sepsis protocol. As set forth in page 8 of our reply brief, Dr. Ford Emergency Services has a protocol that applies in the emergency room and identifies factors for diagnosing sepsis.
I thought that was Christiana Care's protocol.
It says Christiana Care on a document, but it's the emergency room protocol. And Doctors for Emergency Services are the only people that run the emergency room at Christiana Care. So it's their protocol. I mean, they use it every day. They're the ones implementing it, and that's what they live by.
But this was adopted 3 years after your client's death?
It was instituted 3 years after death, correct, Your Honor. Now,
did you have anyone testify that it, despite the fact that it was a protocol that was established 2 or 3 years after the incident, that it nevertheless represented the standard of care on the date of the incident?
Yes, our experts testified to the same factors, the factors that are listed in that protocol. And I should say, we didn't intend to use the entire protocol. The first part of the protocol is how you treat someone with sepsis. But the second page just has a simple diagnosis for sepsis. And those factors were consistent with our expert testimony. And that's why the timing of it is not relevant in this case. It simply relates to a medical diagnosis. They weren't saying they could not diagnose Gale. Well, that the fact. Sorry.
When you made your argument in that you should be able to use it for impeachment and you met the judge's or heard the judge's reasons for suggesting that you would not be able to use it for impeachment, did you then point out to her that for impeachment purposes this document actually represented the standard of care in existence at the time of the incident and it wasn't important that it was drafted for that reason 2 years later?
The trial court denied, well, first, the trial court heard our expert's testimony, which identified the same factors in there. And the trial court really denied our application on two grounds. One, that impeachment can only be used to show untruthfulness, which we submit in this court's holding on Obama versus State is not true. Impeachment can be used for to demonstrate untruthfulness, bias, competency, and contradiction. In this case, we're using it to demonstrate contradiction. And the trial court ground, the second ground, the trial court denied our application.
Contradiction between which parties?
Between Dr. Zelman's testimony and the party he was there to represent's own policy. I mean, he testified to the jury that Gale's signs were not indicative of sepsis, in direct contradiction of the policy. And then he testified to the jury that the factors identified for identifying sepsis were not valid indicators of sepsis, in direct contradiction of their own policy that they employed, that our experts relied on those same factors.
Well, maybe I missed your answer to my question, but in your impeachment argument in favor of using the protocol, did you tell the trial judge that the reason it should be used for impeachment is because, regardless of whether it was drafted by a group of doctors 2 years later, it nevertheless represented the established standard of care on the date of the incident, and any medical professional offering an opinion about the standard of care should be able to be impeached upon by a protocol that indeed represented the standard of care when his testimony was inconsistent with it? Did you make that argument to her?
That issue never came up. The trial court just rejected our first arguments, and I think the record reflects in a quick fashion. There was no dialogue or attempt to establish it. We were just told you're not using it. It wasn't a pretrial. It's as simple as that. It's for dishonesty. She even made a conclusion after one witness's credibility and said, he's not lying. This is an impeachment. That's for the jury to determine. So, Your Honor, that issue just never came up. Turning to our next argument, the trial court erred by giving a curative instruction after plaintiff's counsel's closing rebuttal argument. The challenge statement is set forth in our papers and clearly was supported by the record. At trial, Dr. Munoz and Dr. Hall testified that Doctors for Emergency Services had a duty to care for Gale and monitor Gale while she remained in the emergency room. This testimony was corroborated by DFES's own board, Doctors for Emergency Services, in the emergency room, which tracks the patient the entire time in the emergency room, and the patient's name does not come off that board until they're taken to a floor. There was nothing improper about this comment. And the trial court's statement deprived plaintiff of the right to argue the record evidence and reasonable conclusions be drawn from that evidence. Turning to another error created by the trial court was allowing or not even removing or even questioning Mr. Lagula's father after learning he was a member of the jury. Now, looking at this issue, it's important we look at it from the perspective of Mrs. Sammons and the general public.
What are you suggesting the trial judge should have asked that juror?
She could have asked him a number of questions.
Without revealing a basis, without disqualifying him in the process, assuming he doesn't know.
She could have started, we learned your son's a lawyer. Is that correct? We didn't ask that question in voir dire. I apologize. Does the fact your son's a lawyer affect your ability to be impartial? Do you know the type of law your son practices? Does that affect your ability to be impartial? Do you know if your son knows anything about this case? Do you know anything about your son's cases? Do you know anything about this case? All those questions would have been aimed at trying the prejudice without revealing the purpose.
But weren't those questions, or a broader question within which those would be subsumed, asked in the initial voir dire?
Not aimed, knowing that this juror was the father of an attorney in the case. There was a general question, is there anything you know that may, you know, affect your ability to be impartial? But when that issue comes up, and Mrs. Salmon is there for trial, the trial court has a duty to conduct further voir dire. I mean, this is a lawyer, Mr. LeGros. Ms. Salmon had a lawyer who took her deposition, fought her claims, and his expert testified at trial, sit on a jury. This clearly is an appearance of a bias or a prejudice to the general public and certainly to Mrs. Salmon.
Well, now, I take it Mr. Lugullo served?
I'm sorry?
He served on the jury?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
Did he know that Dr. Zintelman had been his son's expert?
We don't know. The trial court never asked any questions.
Well, he's asked, as I think Justice Ritchie pointed out, isn't he, before the trial, after having read, when the veneer has read to them the list of witnesses, aren't the jurors asked, do you know the names of any of these witnesses? Are you familiar with any of them?
Yes, and he didn't respond to that. But that doesn't take away from the appearance of the prejudice or bias.
Ah, this is one of those appearance of impropriety, even if there's no substance to it, argument.
There could also be substance. We don't know. He wasn't asked any subsequent questions. The case law shows that in these circumstances, the trial court routinely follows up and asks the juror questions. I see I've gone into my rebuttal time, and I'm happy to answer questions of the court. Or if I could, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. It's a difficult argument to respond to because there's so many arguments made, and I had intended to discuss in my few minutes that I have two arguments that were not even made in oral argument by Mr. Farnan, and I'm sort of asking the court, do you want me to simply respond to what's been presented orally or discuss the two issues that I thought needed a little amplification or both?
I think, Mr. Turner, what you should do is respond to the arguments that you think, based on the briefs and the oral argument, the court should focus on in resolving this case, regardless of what was actually argued orally as opposed to what was in the brief.
Okay, and I think what I'm going to do is go through Mr. Farnan's oral arguments that he just presented in sort of a bullet point fashion with my responses. First, the reference to settlement argument. It was clearly discussed at the pretrial conference that the jury would be told of the settlement. It was discussed before the jury was selected that I was going to do exactly what I did. And in my opinion, I did exactly what Alexander versus Cahill permits. That is, reference the fact of a settlement, and that's it. There was no mention of amounts. There was no suggestion that the settlement is evidence of fault. No witness was asked about the settlement. And at the end of, in the jury instructions at the conclusion of the case, the court explained the settling defendants. If the jury had not known the posture of this case, they would have been totally confused because there were about eight defendants who had been named in this case who were not present and to whom reference was going to be made. So I submit that there had to be the kind of reference there was, that it was done in the way that this court has acknowledged as appropriate and that it didn't violate any rule. Secondly,
would you explain to us, given what your opponent suggested were the actual comments made in the closing, why you suggest there was no indication of fault as a result of the settlement?
The
indication of admission of wrongdoing?
There was no statement that the settlement was an indication of fault or an admission of wrongdoing. There was reference in talking about the settling defendants, that there was ample evidence of their fault that the jury could find if they got to that point in their deliberations, which would require them first to find fault against the trial defendants, which they did not. They never got to that point, obviously. But we
and
had
for the purpose of your cross-claim?
Correct. I mean, we had to prove the negligence of the co-defendants who had settled, and we did. And I was certainly permitted to reference in my argument the evidence of that and the fact that if the jury got to that point, they could and should find Christiana Care responsible because it was overwhelmingly clear that there was a breakdown in some of the Christiana Care employees.
Well, I'm getting confused here because I thought you started out by saying that you didn't make any comments that would attribute fault to the settling parties. But I'm looking at what was said, and it sure looks like you're saying Christiana Care made a mistake. It's sad. There were several mistakes, and so on. And Christiana Care is basically the response, and it says if that's their responsibility. They've settled. So aren't you saying exactly what you claim you're not saying?
No, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. In the opening statement, I simply stated that here are the parties who were sued. Here's who they worked for. Here's what their involvement was. They have settled. You may have to consider their fault at the end of this trial. In the closing statement, I recited the fact that here are the settling parties. Here's the evidence against the settling parties, and you can find them at fault if you have to. Dr. Bridges was not identified as a causation expert, and for that reason, I did not go to his deposition and certainly would have if there had been any intimation that he was going to serve a function beyond that for which he was identified. Moreover, as far as I was concerned at trial, it wouldn't have made any difference whether he testified as to causation because he certainly wasn't going to say anything more than had already been said by the plaintiff's two other experts. Dr. Zentelman, the plaintiffs knew no later than the day after they canceled his deposition on October 27, 2005, that we were going to call him at trial for his causation opinions about sepsis because I called up and left a message followed by a letter. They knew that and made a conscious decision not to take his deposition. When they made that conscious decision, I then amplified his opinion so they couldn't argue that they didn't know the full scope of his proposed testimony.
Before you leave that point, I'm interested in what the general practice is in Superior Court and whether there's a consistency among Superior Court judges in how they handle this kind of dispute. As I understand it, in the discovery process, one identifies the expert, the opinion that for which the expert is being offered, and a general summary of the facts that support that opinion. From that point on, a party is on notice that they can anticipate deposing that expert or cross-examining that expert, or if they want to leave it at that, on that basis. What is the necessary step, if any, in order to notify a party that you have, in fact, expanded the opinion or the purpose for which you're calling that expert? Is there a follow-up document that supplements the earlier document, or is it simply notice because he or she says something more at their deposition, or there's a supplemental unrelated interrogatory, or someone else's deposition says that he once said that, or a document has it that's supplied later. What's the test for knowing when you take that expanded opinion seriously?
Well, I'll try to answer what I think Your Honor's getting at. In this case, the identification of Dr. Zentelman was a sort of a bullet point identification. Here's who he is, here's what his qualifications are, and here are the general areas he's going to testify. And there was a one-sentence identification on causation. Now, I think most Superior Court judges, if not all, if the adequacy of that identification had been challenged by plaintiffs, and they could have challenged it by filing a motion to compel a more responsive answer, I think most, if not all, Superior Court judges would say you need to give them more information on this so that they can take an intelligent deposition. But that was never done, and in many cases it's not done because most lawyers have the confidence that they can elicit the nature and bases of an expert's opinions at deposition so as to be prepared to deal with it. But it has never been permitted, in my experience, that you can identify an expert for one subject matter And then after he's been deposed by defense counsel, as was the case with Dr. Bridges in this case, say, oh, by the way, do you have any opinions about this other area? And that's what happened. There was never any further identification of how those opinions evolved, what their basis was. And as the attorney for Doctors for Emergency Services, I didn't have any opportunity to explore that because I didn't think I needed to be there because I wasn't really concerned with the opinion for which he'd been identified.
So it wasn't you who said that it was okay to let him testify to the extent that he did in his deposition?
Oh, I did say that because, as I've said, I don't think it made any difference because he wasn't adding anything, at least that we were on notice of, to what the other two experts were talking about.
Okay, but I guess what I'm interested in is, isn't that basically the way it works in terms of the practice among attorneys and the court, that if an expert is identified, the expert's report or the designation of his expertise tends to be pretty cursory, whether it should be or not. It tends to be a little bit short. And you take the person's deposition, and then you have a more expanded understanding of what this person's going to testify about, including perhaps some areas that may be technically beyond what the original designation was. And everybody says, okay, well, you know, what he's said in his deposition is now the scope of his expert testimony. Isn't that pretty much the way it works?
That's partially correct, but it misses one point, and that is it's frequently the case that an expert is identified in a cursory way, that Dr. So-and-so will say that the defendant met the standard of care or breached the standard of care. But if the witness is going to – causation and standard of care are the two – pillars of medical negligence cases, and it's very important to know who's a standard of care witness and who's a causation witness and who is something else. And in this case, Dr. Bridges was identified only as a something else, which is the reason I didn't feel I needed to take a few hours and go deposing on what I thought was a very narrow issue. I want to make one comment about a statement made about Dr. Zendelman, that he offered standard of care testimony. That's not referenced in the papers anywhere. I certainly didn't ask him any standard of care questions. I proffered him solely as a causation witness within the realm of his expertise of infectious disease. And if Mr. Farnan wants to cite the court to some reference that he thinks is prejudicial, I could respond. The sepsis protocol issue, that is a total red herring, because what the plaintiff tried to extract, well, first of all, the way this was done was totally inappropriate. If the plaintiffs wanted to use this document in any way at trial, they should have listed this, and there probably would have needed to be a hearing about it, because this document, which postdates the events at issue by 3 years, reflects a pretty sophisticated evolution of medical thinking about sepsis and something called systemic inflammatory response syndrome, which the court would have to understand before it could even intelligibly approach the issue. But instead of letting the court know that there was this issue they wanted to raise, what the plaintiffs did was call the defendant, Dr. Rosenbaum, to the stand before their expert testified and say, and Dr. Rosenbaum's involvement with the patient was minimal. He was the initial attending emergency physician who saw the patient, ordered tests, and then his shift ended. And he was put on the stand and said, in your opinion, did the patient have sepsis? And he said, not as far as I know. And then this document was handed to him. Well, the document has a whole bunch of stuff in it, and it's included in our appendix. But among other things, it's an algorithm. But what the plaintiffs wanted to use it for was to go over factors such as vital signs, respirations, pulse rates, white counts, things of this nature. And they were permitted to do that with Dr. Rosenbaum and with Dr. Zendelman without any restriction. They just were not allowed to do it in the context of this protocol, because the protocol would be a suggestion, at least, that here's a series of steps that have to be followed in this order as of November 2004, and maybe you didn't do it. And that's what was inappropriate about the way the plaintiffs attempted to approach it. But the idea that they were not permitted to cross-examine and impeach the witnesses on the substance of the medical factors is simply not true. They were permitted to cross-examine on those factors without any restriction. They just simply weren't allowed to make reference to the protocol, as they should not have been.
Was there any testimony from any witness that the protocol, whatever it contained, represented a statement of the standard of care for the diagnosis of sepsis on the date of the incident?
No. No witness did. The plaintiff's witnesses didn't refer to it at all, and had they done so, we would have had to have a hearing on it, because it's not a simple thing that 1, 2, 3, 4, and it's sepsis. That's sort of the way the plaintiffs approached this, but the answer is no. And I'm running out of time. I've run out of time.
You are out of time. Thank you, Mr. Turner.
May it please the Court, Colleen Shields here on behalf of Dr. Family Practice Associates and Dr. Sobel. The arguments that the plaintiff made initially with respect to the reference to Christiana's settlement and an indication that there was argument that we were attempting to shift liability to Christiana on the basis of the settlement. Settling defendants always present a challenge for the defendants at a trial, because we have preserved cross claims against the settling defendants, and we're going to have to be able to ask the jury to apportion fault against them in order to take advantage of the joint tortfeasor release that the settling defendant executes. Otherwise, the plaintiff is entitled to get a windfall if they're able to settle for, you know, a nearly full value of the case and then ask the jury to value the case at full again, and we're not entitled to an apportionment and to seek a set-off in the amount that the settling defendant settled for. So it's a challenge, and the plaintiffs kind of suggest, well, you told them that they settled and you suggested that there was fault, and so you're asking the jury to jump to the conclusion that the settlement is in recognition of that fault. Well, we didn't specifically ask the jury to jump to that conclusion, and that's what the Alexander decision prohibits. But it's a fine line, admittedly so, but it's one that the defendants have to walk narrowly, because they have to tell the jury that they're settling defendants so that the jury understands that there's going to be a party who hasn't been there and hasn't presented evidence, and they're going to be asked if they find ultimate fault to apportion liability against that defendant. And then we also have to suggest the fault so that the jury has some basis on which to apportion liability. So we have to do it in a manner where we're not suggesting that the settlement is an acknowledgement of the fault, but we have to do both. We have to tell the jury they're not there, and we also have to tell the jury that our experts said that they were at fault.
I understand your point about the cross-claim and the joint tortfeasor release, but why is it that you have to do it? Why isn't there an instruction crafted by the trial judge that takes that fine line into consideration? And the parties, as I think Alexander versus Cahill suggested, are charged with getting together on what that language should be, having the trial judge review it, and letting the trial judge tell the jury about the alignment of the parties and the relative claims of the parties and the significance of a cross-claim. Why do we get to the slippery slope of possibly crossing that fine line when counsel argues that an absent party is truly the only party at fault, and in a inferentially absolve my client who's here of any fault, because after all, the party who we think is at fault has settled?
Well, if the trial judge has to present everything to the jury in an unbiased fashion, and clearly the defendant has to be able to argue as an advocate for their client the fault of the other party, and the trial judge would be prohibited from saying the evidence revealed that there was fault on the part of the hospital, that the defense witnesses testified, three of them, Dr. Wehner, the emergency room expert, Dr. Hall, a hematology expert, and Dr. Funk, a family care expert, all testified that the hospital's nursing staff's care of the patient fell below applicable standards, specifically that the nursing staff failed to implement the family medicine residents' orders and that they did not report in a timely fashion or at all, on the deterioration of the patient's condition to any physician involved in her care. So it was essential for the remaining defendants to be able to argue from the position of an advocate of their client that those criticisms directed by the defense experts represent the fault of the party who is arguably responsible for the death of the patient.
Thank you.
With respect to Dr. Bridges, Dr. Zentelman argument, the trial judge, it's an abuse of discretion issue, and the trial judge clearly articulated a thorough, well-reasoned basis for his decision regarding keeping Dr. Bridges from offering the causation opinion, and that was the fact that trial scheduling orders that are implemented by the court at the onset of discovery are an order that cannot be ignored. They have the same full force and effect of any other order that is issued by a judge in the Superior Court. And in this case, the plaintiffs attempted to circumvent the trial scheduling order. The trial scheduling order specifically indicates a deadline on which parties must identify the nature of the opinion, their expert, and the nature of the opinion that they intend to elicit from that expert. In this case, that had well expired by the time that Dr. Bridges was deposed. We were well beyond the deadline for the plaintiff identifying new areas or supplemental opinions from Dr. Bridges. And so the trial court said, we can't have you doing that. You can't circumvent trial scheduling orders on your own by simply asking questions of a physician at his deposition at the close of the deposition. I mean, defense counsel had completed their deposition when the plaintiffs tried to elicit these causation opinions, and so that was why the trial court prohibited it in this manner. They certainly could have moved the court for leave to supplement opinions outside, but they chose to try to circumvent it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Hadn't there been a stipulation between the parties to extend the discovery cutoff?
For a limited period of time, and that period had also well expired by the time of Dr. Bridges' deposition.
It had?
It had.
Okay.
That had expired by the time of Dr. Bridges' deposition. We had expanded the time frame for taking depositions, but not the time frame for identification of experts. By the time Dr. Bridges was deposed, that had
expired.
Would
it have made a difference if they had supplemented their original notice to you, asked the court for permission to supplement their original notice, and that permission had been granted?
Certainly, because then the parties would have been on notice and prepared for the deposition in a manner where they were going to be exploring the causation opinions.
Well, I understand the difficulty, and Mr. Turner made it clear about the reason he didn't appear at the deposition, because he believed that the expert witness's opinion would be limited to life expectancy, at least as I read the record. But let's say the deposition's completed and there's been no move to supplement that original statement of the opinion that Dr. Bridges was going to give. But then hearing that Dr. Bridges at the deposition, at whatever point in time during the deposition, was willing to give an opinion on causation as well, if plaintiff's counsel had filed a motion with the court to supplement or amend the earlier designation and that had been granted, would you have redeposed Dr. Bridges, or would you have been sufficiently prepared because all he was, as Mr. Turner stated, was a cumulative witness on that issue in any event? Would you have been prepared simply to go to trial and cross-examine him on his causation opinion?
I certainly would have asked for the opportunity to redepose him, because in preparation for my expert depositions, I often consult with my experts in that particular area in order to formulate questions to ask of that witness. So I would have asked the court for the ability to redepose Dr. Bridges had the court decided to grant leave subsequent to his deposition.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Am I out of time? Thank you.
May it please the court. Turning to the post-trial proceedings in this case relating to Dr. Munoz and the affidavit of merit he filed. The short answer is Dr. Munoz was qualified to execute the affidavit of merit.
Was this part of your opening argument, and did they respond to this? Did I miss this argument?
No, we didn't address an opening argument, Your Honor.
Well, is it fair for you to address it for the first time at oral argument when they didn't hear it in your opening?
If the court doesn't want me to address it, I can address the things they address. But
if another justice will want to
listen. I only have one procedural question that I just would like to have answered, and that is the Judge Abelman entered an order of dismissal. Now, was the judgment as a result of the jury verdict ever vacated?
No, it was not. I don't believe there's been an order entered vacating the jury's verdict.
So there was a judgment entered and then a dismissal following the entry of a judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Returning to the arguments raised in our opening. First, Dr. Murray's service counsel said that the problem was we didn't take Dr. Zellman's deposition. If we took the deposition, we'd be in the same place we are today. We've gone to deposition. He would have given new opinions about a new date at a new hospital, and we were moved to preclude those opinions. Second, they also said that Dr. Zellman never gave opinions on standard care, and that we just made that up today. If you refer to footnote 9 of our reply brief, you'll say we specifically talk about his opinion, and we cite to the record where he talks about the administration of antibiotics, and that we believe that was standard care testimony. Third, Mr. Shields, in response to a question, stated that Dr. Bridges' deposition was after the expert discovery deadline. That's simply not true. It's cited in the record, and we supply the scheduling order that shows that was August 31st, 2006, and his deposition was prior to that. Going back to an issue previously raised, and that is the inability to impeach Doctor for Emergency Services witnesses with the sepsis protocol. There is no doubt that the trial court misapprehended the law on this issue. They had a sepsis protocol, which their witnesses got up there and gave testimony that directly contradicted it. Their own expert witness did not acknowledge what their own standard of care was. Plaintiffs have a right to challenge his testimony and to contradict it with impeachment. And impeachment doesn't have to be listed in the pretrial order because it's not going in as evidence. It's simply to challenge the soundness of an expert's opinion or any witness's testimony. It's simply so there's no reason to give notice. And for these reasons, we respect.
But doesn't contradiction imply that you're contradicting a statement of the witness with an earlier statement of the witness?
I think you're just contradicting the witness's testimony. He said that's not a valid indicator of sepsis, and we're saying the people you're here to testify for use this every day. This is what they think are valid indicators of sepsis. And for these reasons, we respectfully request that this court remand this case for a new trial and vacate the orders entered in the post-trial proceedings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I will take the case under advisement and recess.